Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, we look at the Pfizer vaccine for younger children. The CDC could give the go-ahead for vaccination for kids ages 5 to 11 this week. And later, it's a conversation with Selena Yip, director of the Philadelphia Asian American Film Festival. But to begin, it's hard to believe an entire year has passed since the tumultuous general election of 2020. But tomorrow is Election Day 2021, and we'll spend the first part of today's show reviewing races and candidates, ballot questions, the protocol for voting, and more. In New Jersey, the top race is that for governor, Democrat Phil Murphy seeking a second term. His opponent is Republican Jack Cittarelli. There are no statewide elections in Delaware this year. And in Pennsylvania, there are a fair number of significant judicial elections. Philadelphians will also vote for district attorney and consider several ballot questions. And there are prominent contests in the collar counties as well, including some superheated races for local school boards. WHYY political reporter Katie Meyer is with us now as we take a deeper look at how Tuesday's election is shaping up. Hi, Katie.
Hi, good morning.
So let's take a look at some of the issues regarding school board elections first. Katie, you and fellow reporter Mallory Falk posted a Keystone Crossroads report this morning on this. These elections are normally relatively mild affairs to which few voters pay attention. But this year, national tensions are driving many of these elections, like that in Avon Grove in rural Chester County. Tell us more.
Sure. So, yeah, we looked at a few different school board races that we sort of identified as particularly contentious. And so basically what's been happening is across the country, school boards, I mean, it's kind of the entry level for politics in a lot of ways. You'll see people really understanding and taking advantage of the fact that these are powerful local elected positions. And so especially if, you know, somebody has strong political opinions but not much political experience, the school board is often, you know, it makes sense to run for that. In Pennsylvania, they have a say in property taxes, for instance. You know, they can really make a difference in local curricula. And we've seen, though, specifically people getting really caught up in national issues. So in school board after school board, and we looked at, you know, dozens and dozens of them across the state, over and over, you saw people very upset about, you know, masking in schools, vaccines. The idea of like whether schools could be closed down again if COVID spikes and when that would happen. You know, it's significant issues because kids have kind of suffered from being out of school for a long time. So, but I think the big thing that we looked at is money that's going into these school board races. And specifically, this is very unusual. There was a guy named Paul Martino, a venture capitalist based in Bucks County, who poured thousands and thousands. It ended up being over $500,000 of his own money into 55 different school board races across the state. And it was in like $10,000 increments, and some was added later. And so he was saying, you know, this is a bipartisan effort. It is meant to bolster the case for keeping kids in school, keeping schools open in person. What we found was, A, it really wasn't that bipartisan. You know, we reviewed, you know, basically the voter registration of all of the candidates he'd given to. There were some Democrats, only like 10 or so, and, you know, the vast, vast majority of the people that got this money were Republicans. And what we were finding was, you know, in many, many cases, they were worried about different issues than just keeping schools open. So something called critical race theory, which has been a big topic of conversation. It's a framework, an academic framework, mostly used in legal scholarship. So things like that, masking, vaccines, so these kind of big issues that have been very contentious. So, yeah, the long and short of it is these races got pretty ugly this year.
Yeah, we'll see how this all plays out tomorrow. I mean, candidates and current school board members subject to sometimes to ridicule and even threats. So tense situation. Thank you for that, Katie. Let's go to judicial elections in Pennsylvania. A reminder, you know, judges are elected. These races are also often don't grab much voter attention, but they're as important, if not more so, than many other races because, Katie, as you report, these new judges will wield a lot of power.
And they stay in elected office for a long time. These are 10-year terms. And once a judge hits those 10 years, they're up for retention, which is just a yes or no, up or down vote, which they almost never lose unless they've, like, you know, been convicted of a crime or something. So, you know, it's almost a lifetime appointment. And, yes, the Pennsylvania judges, they run under the banner of a political party. These are partisan elections. And so we have an open seat for Supreme Court. The two people running are Maria McLaughlin, a Democrat from Philadelphia, and Kevin Brobson. He's a Republican from the Harrisburg area. McLaughlin's on the Superior Court right now. Brobson's on the Commonwealth Court. We've got a Superior Court race as well. There's an open seat on that court. There are two open seats for the Commonwealth Court. And we have explainers. It's a lot to get into because often this is about, like, the jurisprudence of a judge.
Sure.
But if you haven't voted yet, we have explainers up on our website, whyy.org. And if you, you know, you want to get brush up a little bit on those judges, I would encourage you to read that.
Yeah. Well, and let's just go to the state Supreme Court for one moment.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, it's currently comprised, I believe, of five Democrats, two Republicans. Mm-hmm. Chief Justice Thomas Saylor retiring. He's a Republican. You know, the GOP is not going to make a difference in terms of the majority this go around, but the party wants to make sure a Republican replaces him because there have been significant decisions made by the Democratic majority in recent years, including one which affected Pennsylvania's congressional districts.
Yeah, absolutely. This has been a huge issue for Republicans in Harrisburg, especially just because in 2015, that was when we saw this influx of Democrats to the court. And you're right, this is really not going to affect the partisanship of the court, but Republicans don't want to lose any more ground. So they don't want a situation where they only have one Republican on the court, even though these aren't supposed to be partisan positions necessarily. And judges will say, you know, I'm not a partisan. I'm going to rule the best way I think I should rule. I mean, people do view them often as partisan decisions that these judges make. And you're right, the biggest one, one of the biggest ones that people were quite incensed about, Republicans, was the decision a couple years ago that redrew Pennsylvania's congressional map because the court found that it was an unconstitutional Republican gerrymander. And that gave Democrats, you know, a much better shot in Congress. And it evened out our congressional delegation to 9-9, where Republicans had a very big advantage before.
All right, let's go to Philadelphia. Constituents will be voting for district attorney. Incumbent mm-hmm. Democrat Larry Krasner being challenged by Republican defense attorney A. Charles Peruto. Peruto's chances at unseating Krasner, not very good.
Not very good. I spent some time in the last couple of weeks talking to Krasner, talking to Peruto, talking to people who, you know, live in neighborhoods that are most affected by gun violence in Philadelphia, because that's really what this race, even though it's not competitive, really, that's what this race is about. And I'll just say Philadelphia, the reason it's not competitive is Philadelphia has an enormous advantage among Democratic voters. It's just a registration advantage. And so Republicans have a really hard time winning citywide. So we saw, I don't know, a fairly competitive primary that Krasner won really easily. And so this is not expected to be a difficult race for him. The fact remains, this is a time in Philadelphia where we're seeing a huge spike in gun violence, and that's what Peruto is running on, is saying that Krasner's policies, he's been very anti-mass incarceration. He's saying that those kinds of policies are, you know, hurting the city.
Yeah, well, and in fact, there have been over 450 homicides this year in Philadelphia. Both Police Commissioner Daniel Outlaw and Mayor Kenney are questioning whether Krasner's office is aggressive enough in seeking penalties for people illegally carrying guns. But despite this, Katie, Krasner apparently has considerable support in communities which are being ripped apart by gun violence. What are you hearing about the reasons why?
Yeah, well, I'll just say on the carrying guns thing, you know, that has been the big point of contention recently. Krasner has rebutted that, saying that he believes he's getting weak cases from the police, and is also saying that he doesn't think that there is necessarily a link between carrying a gun that you're not supposed to have and using that gun to shoot somebody. And it's really hard to say, just like looking at data, what is the case there. But anyway, so that's the big point of contention most recently. But I talked to a bunch of folks who work in direct gun violence intervention work, so street supervisors in neighborhoods that see a lot of gun violence, community organizers. And one of the things you hear over and over from people like that, especially people who have, you know, been in jail in the past and then, you know, gone out and done this kind of work, is that they do think, you know, Krasner's approach, this approach to trying to divert people when you can, or stop, you know, the causes of gun violence, like poverty, like, you know, lack of educational opportunities, job opportunities, things like that. They're saying, you know, that is the more holistic, better way of fighting it. Right now is a painful time. Nobody likes to see these shootings going up. It's awful for these communities. But they say they are still confident in this anti-mass incarceration approach.
Worth noting, another citywide race is that for controller. Incumbent Rebecca Reinhart is running unopposed for another term as Philadelphia's fiscal watchdog. Quickly, Katie, like to get into one ballot question. Philadelphians will consider a question about recreational marijuana. What does this question ask, and if passed, would it have an actual effect on legalization?
Yeah, so this is really more of a statement of values, I think. Philadelphia years ago already decriminalized possession of small amounts of marijuana, but the city can't legalize it on its own. The state would have to do that, the legislature. And so far, they've talked about it. There's some bipartisan support for it now, but they haven't moved yet. This would basically say that Philadelphia, as a city, supports the legalization of recreational cannabis marijuana for people 21 and older. So you can have it, you can sell it for non-medical purposes, because Pennsylvania already has medical marijuana. So again, this wouldn't make it legal. This wouldn't do really anything other than say, we as a city support this change.
Okay. To the mechanics of voting, mail-in balloting has been underway for some time now. What are the options if a person is voting by mail but hasn't placed that ballot in the mail yet? Tomorrow, again, is Election Day.
Yeah, so you can put your ballot in a drop box. There are several around the city. We have a map up on Billy Penn, our site Billy Penn, under WHYY, and they have just a little interactive map where you can see the one that's closest to you. You can also always drop it off at the election office at City Hall. If you're in a situation where, your ballot got messed up or you lost it somehow, or it never arrived, but you know that you applied for a mail ballot, you can go to vote in person at your polling place, which you can look up online, and you should be able to cast at least a provisional ballot if you don't have the actual physical mail ballot on you. That's an option, again, if something happened to the ballot. But otherwise, you can still put it in a drop box. I would say don't put it in the mail. It is too late for that if you've got a mail ballot. But then, if you didn't apply for a mail ballot, go ahead and vote in person at your polling place. And you can check online to see where that is.
And polls are open early tomorrow, 7 a.m. in Pennsylvania and Delaware, 6 a.m., I believe, in New Jersey. We've got about 30 seconds left. Just let's get back to the courts for a second. You mentioned there's one 10-year seat open on Superior Court. This race, it might not generate a whole lot of interest, but it probably should, Katie.
Sure. I mean, all the court races are a big deal. The Superior Court race, totally the same. That one is between Tamika Lane, she's a common pleas judge in Philly, and Megan Sullivan, a Republican. She works for the Chester County District Attorney's Office. They're both recommended by the Bar Association, so it's not, super controversial there. But, the Superior Court, more partisan mix than the Supreme Court right now. So definitely these elections are always a big deal.
All right, Katie Meyer, thanks so much.
All right, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Katie Meyer is WHYY's political reporter. Up next on the regional roundup, we get the latest on what's happening with COVID-19 vaccines for children ages 5 to 11. Our guest is Dr. Lawrence Kleiman of Rutgers University's Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The federal government is ready to distribute millions of doses of the Pfizer COVID vaccine for children ages 5 to 11. A CDC advisory panel is expected to meet tomorrow and Wednesday. And if final approval is given, the vaccine could be available to younger children as early as Thursday. States including Pennsylvania and New Jersey have ordered hundreds of thousands of doses slated to go to pharmacies, pediatricians, and children's hospitals. So how does COVID vaccination work in younger children? What sort of demand will there be for this vaccine? And could vaccination for children eventually mean an end to masking in schools? Our guest is Dr. Lawrence Kleiman, professor and vice chair of the Department of Pediatrics at Rutgers University, Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. Welcome.
Good morning, Mary. A pleasure to be here to speak with you.
Before we get going, let me give the number for our listeners, 888-477-9499. Questions or comments, you can also send an email to radiotimes at whyy.org or tweet us at whyyradiotimes. So, Dr. Kleiman, how would you characterize the potential approval of a COVID vaccine for children in this age group?
As a pediatrician and a parent, I'm very excited to see that this is happening. I think that vaccination of these children and hopefully, if safe and effective, of the younger children younger than five will really signal the opportunity for us to move forward into the next phase of normal.
In an op-ed recently, you say that informed by research, you and other child care experts have been calling out the myth that children are spared from COVID. How are younger children affected by COVID-19?
Well, we're still learning all the details, but we know that young children can get very sick with pneumonia or other acute illness. These young children can get the inflammatory syndrome known as MISC. And fortunately, it's very rare, but a few of them will die. We also don't know yet the long-term consequences of COVID infection in children. We know that there are long-haul children. We don't know yet how frequent it is. And so I think we have to be cautious about this illness and do what we can to prevent it in children.
So the actual Pfizer vaccine for kids ages 5 to 11, not exactly the same as it is for adults. Tell us about the dosage.
The dosage is one-third of that for adults, and one would expect that given there's a positive immune response, and in the studies they have not seen serious side effects like the myocarditis, that we will have many fewer infections and rare bad reactions. We don't know that they will be zero, but I think it was prudent for them to reduce the dose, and that seems to be borne out in the trials.
So that was one of the greater concerns, the risk for the myocarditis, which is an inflammation of the heart muscle. You're saying then that in the studies and the research that has been done, we haven't really seen this in the younger children.
We haven't seen it in the younger children. To be fair, the sample size was small enough that it might still be present and happen at a low level, and we wouldn't have seen it. So it doesn't mean there will not be any myocarditis. We do know, however, that the myocarditis that is associated with COVID infection is more frequent than the myocarditis that follows inoculation or vaccination, and it seems to be more experienced. More serious after infection than after vaccination.
So, Lawrence Clayman, I've read about parents who are vaccinated themselves, but still are hesitant to give their younger children the vaccine. What would you say to them?
First thing I'd say is I get it. I am. Reluctant to put anything that I don't know is safe inside my daughter. And this is an emergency use authorization and not a full authorization because of the sample size that was there. So I understand and appreciate that caution. That being said, I am convinced based on the evidence out there with adults and the existing evidence with children that it is far safer for your child to have the vaccine than it is to have the illness. Therefore, I think vaccination is, for most children, a good idea. Obviously, every decision is a parent's decision and should, as appropriate, be undertaken with their pediatrician or family physician. My feeling is that on balance, almost all the time, it works out to be a better idea to get the vaccination.
You wear a number of hats. As a pediatrician, are you hearing from caregivers, and is there a majority saying thumbs up or the other way around?
It may be a select population, but what I'm hearing is thumbs up. I'm hearing parents who are anxious to vaccinate their children, who some of them are looking to me for confirmation that I believe the data and think it's a good idea. Many of them have been cautious and afraid to, or I shouldn't say afraid, but reluctant to resume some of their normal activities because their children are unvaccinated and unprotected. and are looking to move forward and are eager for the vaccination. That being said, they're also cautious because, of course, everybody is concerned about what's best for their child. I think most of the people that I've heard from do believe that vaccination is what's best for their child.
If a child has had COVID, is there a need for vaccination?
Yes, there is. COVID conveys some level of immunity for some period of time. It may or may not translate to immunity to other types of COVID, in other words, the different variants. And vaccination seems to be a turbo boost for that. So I think if someone has just recovered from COVID, maybe you can wait a few weeks or a month, and you'll have the advantage of a little more data because a little more time. But we don't know how quickly immunity fades after children get COVID.
Do you advise that children are tested for antibodies before getting the vaccine?
I don't advise that. I'm not sure that there is truly an advantage for that, because we, even if antibodies are present, we don't know how long they will persist.
When it comes to younger children, say ages 5 to 11, who should not get the vaccine?
I think that children with chronic or complex or immunological conditions, some taking certain anti-cancer medications, but these need to be made on an individual basis in conversation with their clinical care providers, with their pediatricians, with their specialists. Most children are able to get the vaccine.
So as we know, masking is required for students and educators in schools in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. If enough children are vaccinated, do you see mask mandates beginning to fall away?
I think it's possible that when these children and their younger siblings are vaccinated, we can begin to move away. Or maybe in families where there are not younger children, there may be the capacity to use less, to do less masking. I think while we still have large segments of the population, in other words, the youngest children still not vaccinated, and since many families have children who are both younger and in the school age, it's hard to see them going away completely right now. But I think this points the way. I have heard suggestion that the vaccine for younger children may be available by the end of the year. So there's light at the end of the tunnel if we can get children vaccinated. Of course, what you mentioned earlier about vaccine hesitancy or parents who may be reluctant to get their children vaccinated may impact that.
Sure.
If people don't vaccinate, then it's harder to move towards mask mandates. It's harder to feel that there is safety and protection without the masks.
We are speaking with Dr. Lawrence Kleinman, professor and vice chair of the Department of Pediatrics at Rutgers University, Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. In the op-ed I referenced earlier, you said the myth that kids aren't affected by COVID is a foundation for many of the errors in the public health response. How so?
Well, I think that the CDC and others early this year in the spring and in the late spring and early summer began to do a victory lap regarding the fact that we could get rid of masks. Adults were getting vaccinated. And it all would have made sense if children weren't a part of the pandemic. But given that children can get the disease, can spread the disease, it didn't make sense to get rid of masks when we did. We all have mask fatigue. I hate wearing a mask. I'm tired of it. I'm ready to see people's faces and show my own. That being said, it matters still, so long as these kids are unvaccinated.
Do you see COVID being a part of a part of our lives for the foreseeable future? Are other variants potentially waiting in the wings?
I think that's potential, and it may be a part of our lives in the future. I think what we need to try to do is to make it, like flu, a part of our lives, something that's a vaccine-preventable illness. Maybe in the wintertime or when COVID is around in a particular community, there may be masking from time to time, either optional or required. But I don't think living with masks on a day-to-day basis is, the ongoing focus on COVID is likely to be here forever.
Let's get back to the public health response. In Philadelphia, Dr. Ayla Stanford of the Black Doctors COVID-19 Consortium has made, frankly, a heroic effort to make certain communities of color have access to COVID testing and health care and vaccination. Will children in these communities, say, across the Delaware Valley, have equitable access to the COVID vaccine once it's received final approval? What is your perception of the public health response here?
I think it's important that we monitor and make sure that there's equitable access, availability, and communication, including the opportunity to have questions answered, because it's both the delivery of vaccine into the community so that it's available, but it's also the capacity to engage with parents and caregivers so that their questions can be answered and that they can be made as comfortable as possible given the information. And I'm committed to doing what I can to that. And I think it's something we will have to monitor, and where there is not an equitable response or equitable access, that will need to be called out and addressed, because clearly this is a disease that has impacted communities of color and communities of disadvantage both more seriously, and really that's not an okay status quo.
One of the concerns many people have is that the vaccines have been developed and approved, seemingly with lightning speed. Remind us a little bit about the vetting process, especially with the children's version of the vaccine, and can parents, again, rest secure in the knowledge that the investigative process has been thorough?
Well, what I can tell you is that the process has been transparent in that the data are presented to federal panels and federal advisory panels. I think that it is remarkable the speed with which this has been developed, and that the testing has been convincing, and the data for children is consistent with that for older children and adults, and therefore it all makes sense. And so I think parents can be confident. What is true is that when we did, for example, polio trials, there were millions of children who were tested or who were given the vaccine during the test. We don't have that now. It is a smaller group, but we have very sophisticated statistical methods that can tell us that the risks are no more than a certain amount. And that is very reassuring. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that in prior for prior illnesses, I've studied the history of diphtheria, which was a disease that ran rampant in the early 20th century. What they did at that time was there was a new therapy. They used anti-serum, which was a brand new idea at the time, and it seemed to be effective. But there were people who said, how dare you do this on our children? So in a particular hospital, they just stopped doing it, and they counted, and they saw the death rate rise. And after a week, they said, okay, that's enough. We don't do it that way anymore. We do it with planned, thoughtful experiments. They have been done, and they are very convincing and all consistent, and that should reassure all of us.
You are also part of something called the RECOVER study. What is this?
So the RECOVER study is a large NIH study headed by a team at NYU, and the Rutgers group is recruiting children into the study to look at long COVID in children and to look at what are called post-acute sequelae of COVID, PASC. And that's long COVID and also the inflammatory syndrome known as MISC, or multisystem inflammatory syndrome of children. And it's a major attempt to understand the long-term risks, on development, on disease, on exercise tolerance. Children from birth or even those who are exposed prenatally, potentially to the virus, all the way up through adolescence and young adults. And then there's a component of the study that's also looking at adults.
Anthony has sent along a comment. He says, it seems like the vaccine would let us get rid of the masks, but now we're vaccinated and wearing masks. We'll have the flu season coming and other viruses, so it seems like we're going to continue masking permanently. It does seem that way, doesn't it, Lawrence Kleiman?
Oh, I think it feels that way. I'm convinced that that's not how it will be. Although I will note that we've seen far fewer flu cases in the last season, or we saw them, probably because of the awareness of distancing and masks and staying home when you're sick. So there may be some good practices during flu season that could involve at some level masks, but it's not mask mandates and generalized wearing of masks. It is, it's much more selective, and we'll have to learn if and how we want to do that. I don't think that mask wearing is consistent with where any of us want to be as a society over the long term.
All right. Dr. Lawrence Kleiman, thank you so much for joining us. CDC could come through with final approval for the Pfizer vaccine for children ages 5 to 11 this week. Great to have you with us, and thanks again for the information.
Thank you, Mary. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Kleiman is professor and vice chair of the Department of Pediatrics at Rutgers University Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. Stay tuned. Up next, Selena Yip is festival director of the Philadelphia Asian American Film Festival, which opens this week. This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The Philadelphia Asian American Film Festival gets underway on Thursday and runs through November 14th. PAF, as it's known, is a celebration of Asian American and Pacific Islander storytelling and film. This year, there's an added layer or dimension to the festival's offerings. The theme is Pause, Unpause, a reference to the attempt to get back to a sense of normalcy during a pandemic which has been with us in varying form for the past year and a half. We'll be talking about some of the films scheduled to be shown and how festival goers can access them. The festival is in a hybrid format this year, both live and virtual. Joining us in studio is Festival Director Selena Yip. So good to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
Let me give the number out. It's 888-477-9499. Send an email along to radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at @whyyradiotimes. So, Selena, tell us more about the concept of pause, unpause, and how it relates to the films being presented this year.
I was telling Paige earlier about the theme and sort of like how our team sort of went about trying to get a theme. We haven't always had themes at the festival. I think we started having themes in like 2018. And the themes are typically more concepts and more reflective of how the staff have thought about the festival. For example, last year we sort of thought more about who we are as a festival, especially because I became festival director last year. So it was more about reflecting on, you know, who we wanted to be in the Philadelphia film landscape. So this year with Pause on Pause, you know, as we sort of continue to go back to in-person things, we really wanted to emphasize sort of like a way of consciously doing that, right? And hoping that and encouraging our audiences to reflect on sort of like what it means to like go back to normal. now that we're sort of also as a festival trying to go back to normal. I say that with air quotes.
You were virtual last year,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So hybrid. So you're kind of halfway there.
Sort of. We only have 6 events this year in person. Our theater performances are in person because, you know, it's theater online is very different, and it's definitely not as satisfying. But our film screenings, we have our opening night and our closing night, and that's sort of the only film screenings that we have. But, you know, back to the theme, it's the reason why we're saying pause and unpause is just the fact that we really want people to just think about it. You know, we're all coming back, or we're all going back to in-person things. Yeah. And we just want to make sure that people are reflecting on what that means for all of us.
And Paige, by the way, is our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. So your centerpiece film is called Wuhan, Wuhan. And as you told Paige, it's a serious look at the personal lives of those who were affected by the pandemic. How so?
So Wuhan Wuhan follows a few different characters at the height of the pandemic in Wuhan, China. The characters, it's a very, very intimate look at different communities and how they're affected by the pandemic. So you're looking at not only healthcare workers, but you're looking at a couple who is about to give birth. You're looking at a family who's separated because only 2 of the family members have tested positive for COVID-19. Mm. Yeah. So although it is obviously it takes place, or it was documented last year, and it takes place in China and not the United States, it very much has parallels to probably how we were all experiencing the pandemic.
Wuhan Wuhan is preceded by a short film called Yellow, that's spelled Y-E-L-L-O, voiced by Michelle Mann. It's the true story of an incident experienced by a young woman of Asian descent. She's at the airport and she smiles at a mother and that mother's young daughter, who react in an unexpected manner.
I'm not sure how, but their eyes got even bigger. Their looks of shock quickly turned into dismay and then disgust. The mother took hold of her daughter's hand and literally ran away from me, ducking under the retractable belt barriers, skipping other people in line, moving with such urgency that others didn't dare question them. I stood there, wondering what had happened. All I did was smile and say hello. Deep down, I knew why. The last thing I heard the mother say was, "We need to wash our hands now." I was saddened. I was hurt.
This is it's a poignant short film. The animation is simple, but affecting. The gentle piano music as well. Selena, important to include the pain of being other in the festival?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the festival really started because of you know, systematic and industrialized othering of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in the film industry. So, and specifically in Philadelphia, but of course that sort of exists everywhere. So yeah. Definitely the festival is trying to use media and entertainment to sort of have folks really reflect and look at the, you know, the way that Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders are subject to this idea of perpetual foreigner. And we're in our 14th year now, and this year it's especially interesting because of all the anti-Asian hate that's going around, and definitely not going around, but, you know, has existed for quite a long time. Yeah. But is really being called into question, is really being discussed. So, you know, our purpose and our hope is that folks will find our festival and really be able to enjoy art that's coming from the festival and truly like celebrate the diversity that is within our community.
Would you go as far as to hope that the festival might actually help to change some racist views regarding Asian Americans?
I would hope so. I think it comes at levels, right? Like even just rethinking stereotypes, that's a huge win to me. If someone comes to our festival and is like, you know, I thought that all Hawaiians were just walking around in hula skirts and coconut bras all the time, you know, right? For them to encounter like real stories and real experiences through film or through theater or you know, food even. That's huge for us. That's why we exist.
You have longer and short film formats. Your personal favorite is the shorts?
Yes, I do. I do really love the shorts. I think shorts, there's just like a very special skill that you have to be able to tell such a concise story in like, you know, 40 minutes or less, yeah. which how we typically define it is 40 minutes or less. But the sweet spot for me is like 20 minutes, you know.
Well, let's talk about A New Normal, which is a short film addressing the diaspora from India and how it can be difficult for those who go abroad to maintain the comfort of family ties, even with virtual communication. Here we hear the thoughts of a young woman.
That freedom came at a cost because I had to make a new start in a new country. When you come from a place like India, there is one thing you take for granted, that there are always somebody within arm's reach to support and talk to you.
The stretching and even breaking of family ties is a complex issue for which there are no easy answers.
That is very true, yeah.
Yeah. Do you hear from others within the Asian American community in Philadelphia of these stories? And I guess I should ask, how do you vet your entries? Where do they come from? How do you search for them? And how do you make a decision as to which ones pass muster for the festival?
So we're a submissions-based festival. So we receive submissions through a film freeway portal. So that's how we get a majority of our submissions. We have a screening team that watches every single one of the submissions that we receive. And then we also have a programming team. Our two programming directors will go and look at other festivals to see what's being programmed at, you know, either Sundance or Tribeca. We'll definitely look at other Asian American and Pacific Islander film festivals, not only in the United States, but also sort of around the world.
And this year you're featuring over 100 films.
That is correct.
Which is the most
ever. Yes, that is correct.
So Thursday night, opening night film is called American-ish. Tell us about this film.
I think Iman, who's the director, said that this is the first Muslim American rom-com directed and written by a Muslim American woman. It's incredibly enjoyable. It follows three young women who are sort of just trying to navigate life as Muslim American women. It's wonderful. You can definitely tell that it's directed and written by women for women. It's just so enjoyable, and I'm so excited to open the festival with something that's so light and full of laughter, I think.
So, and is this being screened at the Asian Arts Initiative Theater?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Which is a live film venue. I get the word out. It's also a black box experience. What's a black box in theater?
It's just a smaller theater. It's not like a movie theater. So the space is set up to be pretty versatile. So that's also the same space that we're going to use for our theater performances, our music showcase. The chairs are movable, so that's sort of why it's like the black box theater.
So with a nod to the pandemic, though, capacity is limited.
Very.
Tell us about that.
Yes.
And what do you expect of patrons?
So it's very, very limited. I think it's about like 30-40% of what we typically have. We're usually able to cram like 100-150 people into that theater, but we are limiting it to only 45 audience members and then a few of our staff. And we have
Fully vaccinated.
Yes, yep. Fully vaccinated. So we have vaccination checks at the door. You have to, your last vaccine dose had to have been 2 weeks prior to whatever event you're attending. So we'll be very meticulously actually checking the dates. Everyone is masked indoors. The only time that folks are allowed to be unmasked are in designated eating areas. And the performers and filmmakers who are on stage, either doing a Q&A or a performance, are allowed to be unmasked on stage, but will be masked once they come off stage.
So, and again, the festival is both a mix of live and virtual. And you'd said, Selena, that there was a silver lining to the virtual format in that, you know, it's accessible to people who might have had difficulty attending otherwise, like your folks.
Yeah.
Perhaps would not be able to make more than the opening night, right?
Right.
So tell us more about that.
Yeah, my parents, they live like 45 minutes outside of the city. They live in the suburbs, and that's like where I grew up. My parents, being that they are quite traditional Chinese American parents, they, you know, they were never like super, super supportive of me doing art stuff. And so I was always kind of expecting them never to like really show up. And I mean, they have, I've been doing this since like 2018. And they started coming in 2019. They came to like a opening and closing night. And then in 2020, they literally watched a film, at least one film, like every single night of the festival, because they were working from home. They were able to sort of just like eat dinner and then enjoy a movie. They didn't have to worry about traveling. They didn't have to worry about, you know, like, running errands. Like, there was just like really nothing else that they needed to do. And it was really enjoyable for them to be able to watch these films together and then for them to like text me and like talk to me about it.
So they're supportive now.
Yes. I mean, they've always been supportive, but I think it's about like showing up, right? Like, I think it's.
But this career is okay for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I love what I do. I think it's so much fun to be able to connect people in the way that I do, not just like audiences to film, but also, you know, filmmakers to other filmmakers. Seeing the collaborations that come out of the meetings that happen at the festival is really incredible. And I really hope to continue seeing that as, you know, as we start doing more in-person things again.
So again, hybrid this year. Do you miss the crowds?
Of course. I miss meeting new people. So even meeting you right now, I'm like, oh my gosh, I remember how to interact with people. That's incredible. We had our preview party back in October when we launched our ticketing, and standing up in front of people, I was like, I don't remember how to talk to people. I just like don't remember how to like have conversation.
I think we've all gone through that.
Yeah. It's, I mean, I'm such an extroverted person. And so like during the pandemic, I was like, oh my God, I'm not meeting any new people. So I guess I can just be and like exist and not, you know, not have to think about like my public persona. But now I have to like prepare, you know, there's only a couple of days until opening night. So
Thursday.
I'm like, looking at the mirror and just being like, okay, this is what you're going to say. And it's going to be all right. Don't look at anyone in the eye. It's all right. You're going to be fine. You're going to be fine. Everything's going to be fine.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it will be. You know, so again, it opens the Philadelphia Asian American Film Festival opens on Thursday, the 4th, runs through the 14th. Break a leg.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure having you here with us in studio on the Regional Roundup. Selena Yip, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our engineer today is Diana Martinez. Our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, great to have you with us, and be well.